Thank you, sir. Well, my assigned topic is anti-Americanism in Russia. But before I proceed to that, I'd like to say a few words about the subject of anti-Americanism in general. One thing that has not been mentioned this morning is that a great deal of anti-Americanism derives from ignorance of America. And I speak from a private experience. As our chairman has mentioned, I was born and raised in Poland. And I remember when I was 13 or 14 years old, which would have been 36 or 37, in school, I circulated a memo to my colleagues and said, let's form an anti-American alliance. Now, why? All I knew about America came from movies. That is, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy, whom I loved and laughed at, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I had no idea that in America there were small towns and villages, that there was private property protected, that one had freedom of speech in America. All I knew was these vulgar movies, which amused me, but weren't serious. At the time, I was enamored in Nietzsche. I read Schopenhauer. I was writing a book about Giotto, the Italian Renaissance painter, and I thought America just was not a serious country. So I thought it was a vulgar country that polluted world culture and should be fought. And I remember an incident that occurred when we landed in Hoboken, New Jersey, on July 11, 1940, having escaped Nazi Germany. That was my 17th birthday. And we stood on the deck of the ship, and my father noticed there was a young man leaning against a lamppost. And he said, look, they relax. They are not manic workers, all of them. And that was good, but that shows you how little we knew. All I knew is New York City and Los Angeles. Now let me turn to my own subject. We have to distinguish in dealing with attitudes of Russians to America between, first of all, the governments, the Tsarist government and the Soviet government, and then among three groups of public opinion, conservative, liberal, and radical, because they all had different attitudes. But I must say that America did not play, until very recently, a large part in Russian mindset. It was a country, exotic country, way beyond the horizon, with which Russians had very little contact and knew even less than I knew in the 1930s. The Russian foreign influences came from Germany and from France, where many Russians resided. They used to go to the University of Berlin. They used to go to Baden-Baden and Gamble. They used to reside in France and so on and so forth. But America was a very exotic country of which they knew very little, so the role it played was quite small, at least until the 20th century. The Russian government attitudes. America first came to the attention of Russian governments in the reign of Catherine II, in the second half of the 18th century, when the United States declared its independence. And the whole, Catherine was very friendly to the United States, mainly because she was anti-British, and being anti-British, she became pro-American. So was her grandson, Alexander I, who ruled in the first quarter of the 19th century. He corresponded with Jefferson and his chief minister before World War 1812, Speransky, studied the American Constitution and knew about American institutions. Alexander, in fact, regarded the U.S. Constitution as a model, though he never introduced the Constitution into Russia itself. During the Civil War, the Russians were sympathetic to the North, not because they liked so much the Northern system, but because France and England were pro-Southern. The relations between Russian governments and the United States deteriorated at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th, largely because of the very reaction policies pursued by Alexander III and the persecution of the Jews. which by then we had a large Jewish population, and the treatment of Jews in Russia was quite execrable at this time. During the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-1905, the U.S. government was pro-Japanese and not pro-Russian. The anti-Americanism began really seriously in the Soviet period, under Lenin, but particularly after World War II. And that's for obvious reasons, because Russia, under the Soviet government, aspired to be the leading power of the world. They believed the 20th century would belong to Russia, and America was the main obstacle. Europe was exhausted by the First World War, and the Russians thought that that America is the number one capitalist enemy. And they injected into Russian public opinion a great deal of hostility towards America, which unfortunately has survived to this day. The conservative intellectuals and the whole floor of the government and viewed America with askance. Liberals were very pro-American. They viewed the American Constitution as a model for themselves. The Northern Society of the Decembrists, that revolution organization which exploded in December 1825, Northern Society modeled its constitutional project on the American Constitution. And there was one of the Decembrists was led to the execution, a man by the name Konstantin Rylaev, being led to the Constitution, said there is no good government but in America. And this continued to the end of the Tsarist regime. The liberals, later constitutional democrats as they were called, were absolutely 100% pro-American. The radicals were ambivalent. They liked the Constitution, they liked the liberties, they liked the rule of law, but they disliked capitalism and what they called exploitation. One of the leading Russian radical intellectuals of the 60s, Chernyshevsky, wrote the following about America. I quote, "America and Switzerland have no tsars. The chief of state is not hereditary ruler, but is elected by the people for a certain time. This is why the people there have an easier time and an easier life, and that is why the people become richer there. Without such an order, there is no real freedom, but only deception." Now, this comes from one of the leading radical intellectuals in Russia. There's a very interesting attitude of the organization called the People's Will, or Narodnaya Volya, which was the terrorist organization formed in the late 70s, that in 1881, in March 1881, assassinated Tsar Alexander II, the Tsar who had liberated the serfs and who had given Russia for the first time an independent judiciary. The People's Will carried this out. Not long afterwards, when a terrorist killed President Garfield, the Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will, issued a statement to the American people, which I would like to quote because it is typical of the attitude of even the radicals. This is the statement by the People's Will issued in late 1881 in response to the assassination of President Garfield. "Expressing to the American nation deep sympathy on the occasion of the death of its president, James Abraham Garfield, the Executive Committee of the People's Will considers it its duty to assert, in the name of Russian revolutionaries, its protest against the violent actions such as the attempt by Guiteau," the man who actually shot the president. "In the country where the individual freedom provides an opportunity for honest ideological struggle, where the free national will determines not only the law, but also the personality of those who govern, in such a country, political assassination as a means of struggle is a manifestation of that spirit of despotism, the elimination of which in Russia is our task." End of quotation. Now, the Soviet government, as I mentioned, was unequivocally anti-American for reasons which I've spelled out. They ridiculed America. I recalled sometime before Stalin's death in 1953, I read an article in one of the Russian papers which said Americans have absolutely contributed nothing to inventions and technology. The only thing Americans have invented is the waffle iron and the electric chair. That no longer exists, this attitude, but public opinion polls indicate that the majority of Russians still consider America to be an enemy. And President Putin, or coming President Putin, exploits this in many ways. In many of his speeches, he mentions the fact that the United States is hostile to Russia and is an enemy number one. And I was sorry to see the other day that the presidential candidate, Mr. Mitt Romney, defined Russia as number one enemy of the United States. This is not true. It's not number one enemy of the United States. But there is a hostility which resulted from the years and years and decades of hostile Russian propaganda depicting America as a land of exploitation, vulgarity, and everything else. So that will take some time to overcome, and I hope it will overcome, because basically we have really no conflicts, the two countries, and we should get along well. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Professor Kim Holmes. He is a vice president. He works at Heritage. He's a Heritage expert and is vice president foreign and defense policy studies and director of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies. Kim Holmes has served since 1992 as vice president for foreign and defense policy studies and director of Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, except for his tenure as Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs during President George Bush's first term. Holmes directs Heritage team of foreign and defense policy experts in four centers on the front lines of international affairs: the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies, the Asian Studies Center, the Center for International Trade and Economics, and the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. Davis also includes the Washington Roundtable of the Asia-Pacific Press, RAP. Many of Holmes' recommendations have become U.S. policy. His widely published works include the International Acclaimed Index of Economic Freedom, produced annually by the Wall Street Journal, and his 2008 book, Liberty's Best Hope, American Leadership for the 21st Century. Recognized around the globe as one of the Washington's foremost foreign and defense policy experts, Holmes is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, where he formerly served on the Washington Advisory Committee. Previous appointments include the Defense Policy Board, which is the U.S. Defense Secretary's primary resource for expert outside advice, the Board of Directors of the Center for International Private Enterprise, and public member of the United States Delegation to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. While at the State Department, Holmes was responsible for developing policy and coordinating U.S. engagement at the United Nations and 46 other international organizations. Important goals achieved at this time included the United Nations mandates enabling Iraq to make the transition to democracy, the Security Council first binding non-proliferation resolution, the United Nations first mandate requiring the Office of Internal Oversight Services to release reports to member states, and international outcry over Libya's assuming chairmanship of the Commission of Human Rights, which culminated in that body relationship and establishment of the United Nations Democracy Caucus and United Nations Democracy Fund. Holmes earned his doctoral and master degree in history from Georgetown University. He received a bachelor degree in history from the University of Central Florida in Orlando. He was research fellow at the Institute of European History in Germany and adjunct professor of European Security and History at Georgetown University. His other published works include Defending the American Homeland, a post 9/11 task force report, Defending America, a near and long-term plan to deploy missile defenses, and Restoring American Leadership, a United States Foreign and Defense Policy Blueprint. His scholarly articles have appeared in such journals as National Interest, Journal Spagna Italy, Harvard University International Security, and Columbia University Journal of International Affairs. His opinion articles, commentary, and other publications are very widely known. So please welcome Professor Holmes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that very thorough introduction. It's very nice of you. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be in Philadelphia. It's a pleasure to be speaking for the first time before the Philadelphia Society. It's quite an honor to be here. I've heard about this august organization for many, many years, and it's really an honor to be able to address you this afternoon. My topic is anti-Americanism in Europe. Now, so much of the ideas that you've already heard so far today, particularly those about anti-capitalism and the like, and also the attack on modernity, that you find in anti-Americanism, no matter where it is, in America or other parts of the world, you would find these ideas also in Europe, because many of the anti-American concepts were actually born in Europe. So a lot of what you're going to hear is a bit familiar. So I thought what I would do is just dive a little bit more deeply into some of the historical origins of that. But before I do, I have sort of three points of caution about how to think about anti-Americanism in general, but particularly when you look at the Europeans. And the first is that anti-Americanism in Europe is mainly derived from Europe's own struggles with its own history and with its own identity. There are elements of what they've done over the years in reacting to specific things that the United States does, and particularly in its foreign policies. But it is pointless to try to understand European anti-Americanism by mainly examining the arguments that they actually use against America. European anti-Americanism is largely a projection of its internal conflicts and its own emotions onto Americans. There was a reference to this in Paul Hollander's work this morning, when there was a talk about there is, in the case of anti-Americanism, it often seems like an irrational bias that goes beyond what actually is rationally happening, and this is the point that I'm making here as well. Secondly, while there is obviously some truth to the fact that European anti-Americanism is rooted in a resentment of America's world power, we have to realize that its intellectual roots go far back into the past, even before the time America was a world power. Much of European anti-Americanism is actually caught up in Europe's own struggle and its own rebellion, if you will, against the Enlightenment and against religion. And it's a rebellion manifested mainly in the European critiques of American culture that came long before the World Wars and long before the Cold War. So while it's true that no powerful nation is ever greatly admired by less powerful ones, the differential in power can only explain so much when you look at the way the Europeans look at anti-Americanism. And lastly, a word of caution. This was actually referred to by a questioner in the first session. So we have to be careful not to overinterpret what European intellectuals, philosophers, politicians, and other elites say about America. They are important, obviously, but America and the American people are not as unpopular among the people as they are among the elites. That is particularly true in the United Kingdom. But it's also true even in Germany. You can see it in the opinion polls. Americans' positive views of America in Germany and the UK, they kind of go up and down depending on what's going on in the world. But the only place where I think you can say there is sort of an ingrained populistic anti-Americanism is in France. And of course, in Eastern Europe, America is far more popular than it is in Western Europe. So to start, I thought I would start with the typology that Russell Berman had used in his good book. It's a short book published, I believe, by the Hoover Institution on anti-Americanism in Europe. And he explains that there are three types of anti-Americanism in Europe. The first is a pre-democratic elitism against American mass culture. Second is an anti-democratic legacy of the left and communism. We heard about that this morning. And then third, there's a post-democratic resentment of U.S. power and its independence and sovereignty as models over and against the European Union.